Okay, we'll call the first meeting of the House Interim Revenue Committee to order. I want to welcome some of the usual crowd and some new guests here today and new members as well. Representative Hayden, good to see you with us.
Thank you, sir.
Co-chair, Madam Representative Walker.
Good morning.
And Representative Nolan.
Good morning.
Welcome to the Revenue Committee. For those of you who followed us through the session, you'll notice that we have been downsized. I think we had two more members during the session, so perhaps appropriately, I'm going to call this the Declining Revenue Committee. Like that?
Like that.
Yeah. But glad to have our new members with us for today's inaugural meeting. A couple of items at the head of the agenda. We have rules and co-chair's direction. I'll speak real slowly because that's supposed to take us until 9:30. Let's begin with an overview. Unless anybody got any stories they want to tell before we get started? Okay, we'll start with a review of the rules, and those are in your packets. Paul, do you want to go over those for us?
Well, Mr. Chair, one thing I'd like to say first is to make sure that we're getting information to you with the right email address and right address and right phone number. Those are, should be listed there. And if there are any changes to that, please let Cameron and myself know. So what we'd like to be able to do is to periodically email the committee on developments here in Salem, like on a monthly basis or so, and what happens. So we can get that to you quickly and have information in your hands that you can use as you choose. In terms of the rules, Mr. Chair, is these are actually the same rules that were adopted by the last interim committee, the 2000 interim committee. Only changes are number three, the officers of the committee shall be the co-chairs. So since the structure of the committee has changed, as the speaker has appointed co-chairs. The other thing that I would mention is we do have a referral there to subcommittees, another option there to look at if you are exploring some more in-depth analysis on some particular issues is the possibility of work groups, which gives you a little bit more flexibility. And then finally, on number 10, on the in terms of revenue measures submitted by the committee, the rule there is that there would be, at the request of, if there's an outside party who requests it, or it could be a pre-session file bill that would be just from the committee with no request originating from the committee. And that would be something we're likely to take up in the last meeting of the interim.
I think typically, like most interim committees, the November meeting immediately preceding the next session is the meeting at which we would take up the introduction of pre-session filed measures. Are there any questions about the rules?
Mr. Chairman, I haven't reviewed them. Is there any marked difference from the usual and customary rules that are traditionally imposed?
Certainly not for this committee anyway. I can't speak for other committees, but this is same old as far as the rules go again, except as Paul noted, the reference to co-chairs now because of the appointed makeup of the committee. So with that, if there's no further discussion, Chair would move adoption of the House Interim Revenue Committee rules that are before us. Once again, is there discussion on the motion? Any objection? Okay. The rules are adopted. I just have the next item, co-chair's direction. Our direction is west. but for the committee, our direction is we have scheduled how many, six meetings for the interim. Those dates are all set, and if you have not got those to your offices, you can check with.
We've only set the first two.
No, I'm sorry. I guess the judiciary where they're all set. So my mistake. Okay, I was thinking we'd schedule these all out.
The first is November 30th?
November 30th is the next one, yeah. I'm sorry.
So we would set four during the course of 2002.
Okay. We had, at least there had been some discussion, and you may have picked up on it, about meeting remotely, that is, meeting somewhere downstate or elsewhere in the state. I don't know. We can talk about that, but Co-Chair Walker and I were visiting this morning with Paul, given the concerns about the revenue generally in the budget and the expense of taking the show on the road with staff and extra expenses for committee, as well as expenses, I guess, for folks who like to follow the committee's work. We're considering perhaps at least deferring any action on scheduling meetings elsewhere in the state for the time being. It's not a big dollar amount that we're talking about, but I think it's a appropriate recognition of our budget constraints, too, if we're looking at that elsewhere in state agencies. I don't know, anybody have any comments about that?
Yes, I think an off-campus meeting would be good, Mr. Chairman, so I wish that you would reserve your final judgment.
Oh, I will. I'm just, that's our thinking now. Again, we've not scheduled it, and if things look up, especially during the next year, we could always do that. But for now, at least we're going to take a wait and see, I think, before we make any definite plans.
Because the expense is equal for people to leave here to drive to Hamilton or for people from Hamilton to drive here. So there's no savings as far as those who would attend the meetings.
I'm thinking of committee expense primarily in terms of where we go. But we will, that was just a comment. I'll be glad to leave that open if things look like they're turning sunnier and we have the money in the budget to do that. I'm happy to consider that later. Any other comments, Representative Walker? Do you have anything?
No.
Okay. Well, then let's move on to session review. And Paul, we'll start with the major legislation. Committee, we have the slides, but also a packet in your materials this morning that we can follow along as well. And the packet includes the slides. Ed, could we turn the lights down?
I think it helps with the blue. Have the lights down a little bit.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Paul Warner, Legislative Revenue. What we're going to go through with you is what we consider to be the major pieces of revenue legislation. You can have some debate over whether that turns out to be the case as we look back in hindsight, but I think there's a number of very important pieces of legislation that passed in the 99 session, or in the 01 session. And what we've done is draw those out of the large number of bills that have revenue implications. And we've pulled those forward in your document, the revenue measure summary document, so that we have something for the record anyway as to what we thought at the time were the more significant pieces of legislation. Now, the other thing that we've done is go through and kind of lay out some of the factors, external factors, that we thought were really seemed to be the key drivers in revenue policy decisions. And that's what I'll start off with. Is the things that were critical in terms of shaping the short-term budget issues around the 0103 revenue policy. And, you know, I put DICE there as my clip art, and I think that, you know, it's indicative of the fact that those external factors can be the key determinants of what happens. And one of the main things, of course, is the state of the economy. And if the economy is performing well and generating a significant flow of revenue, as it was in the 90s in particular, that did have a huge impact on the options that were available to you in terms of revenue policy. The economy, however, began to slow in 1998 with the Asian financial crisis. Oregon has gone from one of the top performing states to now right near the bottom in terms of job growth. And if you look at the forecast that was used for May, the income growth for the two-year period was about 10.3% compared to 13.4% in the 99-01 period. So that's a significant slowing in the rate of income growth. And if you relate that back to income tax revenue, each 1% reduction is about $80 million for the biennium. So growing 10% instead of 13% makes a difference of about $250 million. And, of course, what we've seen after the May forecast, the September forecast, was down even further as the economy has weakened more than was anticipated in May. So that's a huge factor in shaping options available. The other factors that came into play were the result of either court decisions or previous legislation. Certainly the federal retiree payments, which was, as you recall from the Vogel case in 1998, the last payment there for the unprotected refunds that went back to a three-year period amounted to about $111 million. And those checks have been sent out. You do, by the way, have a research brief there in your packet. I think it's right at the bottom that Ed has put together, kind of reviewing the retiree, the whole convoluted story going back to the Davis case in Michigan in the late 80s and tracing that through and where we've wound up. But that $111 million payment to federal retirees went out in July, and I think some of it spilled over into August, and that has, of course, had an impact on the revenue stream for this biennium. Measure 88 passed the Senate Bill 535 in the 99 legislature, and that increased the cap on the federal subtraction amount from $3,000 to $5,000, a significant change in the income tax policy, but that is effective for the 2002 tax year. So it'll be on your, won't show up on your returns until you file them next a year from this coming spring. But we estimate that'll reduce the general fund revenue by $159 million. Again, that was factored into that planning process as you looked ahead for the budget. And of course, the other element here, and I know there's a lot of concerns about current service budget and whether that's properly defined and whether it's a proper term or not, but it is something that does have a significant impact on budget policy, and that was really a key factor shaping the options available on the revenue side and working with the Ways and Means Committee. Was they're looking at a continuing service budget out here, saying here's revenue, and showing that there was a gap between the two. And as you recall, Chair, meeting with the Ways and Means Chairs, they continue to emphasize that in terms of revenue policy. Now, if we take a little longer term look, look at what's likely to shape revenue policy in the future, I would argue that most of the major legislation that you deal with can be lumped into one of these categories. Certainly demand for services or adequacy is always a huge issue. Taxes are not an end of themselves. They're a means to an end. You raise taxes, you withdraw resources from the private sector in order to provide a service. So that demand for services is always a critical factor in the long term. Our dependence on the personal income tax, those on the Revenue Committee during the session are very familiar with those numbers, that Oregon state tax collections are 69% from the personal income tax. The next state with the most dependence on a single tax is Washington, which is 59% on sales taxes. So very much a system balanced, tilted toward the personal income tax. We did get the 97-98 census data after the session. And that shows that Oregon now has the highest personal income tax burden in the country, just taking personal income tax collections and dividing by income in the state. So really a system heavily dependent on the income tax. Distribution of the tax burden, the OTIM results show that we have essentially a bowl-shaped tax distribution with a higher effective rate at the low end, and the property tax being the primary factor behind that, and are essentially a proportional a tax burden, and then a progressive tail at the other end, at the higher income end, because of the income tax, personal income tax, has that progressive effect. Regional disparities in economic growth, things like Senate Bill 229, were policies designed at getting at regions of the state that have not shared in the growth in the 90s and have tended to be hit even harder as the state has slowed down. So we saw a large number of proposals and do have in the work plan an inventory and an analysis and review of economic taxation, economic development policies.
Paul, if I can just interrupt for a second, for committee members, this is pretty familiar to those of us who spent the first 6 months of the year on the Revenue Committee, and these are exactly the themes we struggled with on an almost daily basis. For the new members, if any of this sparks a question, I don't want to just rush by anything that raises an issue for you, so please feel free to interrupt. This is a good opportunity to kind of get an overview of the revenue system as well. So be my guest to interrupt Paul, just like I did.
Absolutely. And I suspect these are things you'll come back to again and again. I mean, they're the themes that have shaped policy the last few sessions. Another related force is interstate competition. We live in a very open system. The state economy is wide open. Factors can flow across borders. In fact, we have workers flowing across the border on a daily basis. And that has a huge impact on our tax policy because our tax policy can influence the flow of those resources, particularly capital. And this was a major debate, as we'll see when I get to House Bill 2281, which was looking at the corporate apportionment formula, raised that issue. And then finally, land use environmental policy includes a wide array of things, but I'm thinking here about particularly property tax legislation, special assessment, for example. We had a pollution control tax credit issue that we'll get to would fall in this category. And it can be either in terms of tax policy that encourages particular type of use or discourages particular type of use, whether it be land or consumption. So those are kind of the things that I think you can look for to be important as you form a framework for the upcoming session. These things are very likely to come back again in different ways and different guises. In terms of the major legislation, you can see I've been playing around with the clip art during the time here in the interim. These are the bills that we laid out. I'll go through the first two, Senate Bill 963 and House Bill 2281. And then Ed will talk about the Senate Bill 764, which modified the pollution control tax credit, and House Bill 2716, which was changed the working family credit, making it refundable. House Bill 2142 was a transportation bill, and Dick will talk about that. 3537 was a follow-up on a major legislation in timber tax policy in the 99 session, and Dick will talk about that. And then Senate Bill 260 was the bill that the Senate Revenue Committee spent many weeks on, which was setting up a system to move toward equalization in the ESD system. And that was one that will be ongoing, and you'll have some reports from that as the interim progresses, and more than likely be asked to look at some alternatives to that in the next session. Senate Bill 963, this was a bill that actually did not come through the Revenue Committee, came through the Ways and Means Committee, was a major factor in shaping the final budget because of its indirect impact on the 2% surplus kicker. The bill itself has virtually no implications for long-term revenue because it is a one-time shift. It established this MUPL account, which had been, the surplus revenues had been flowing into the general fund. And what this bill did was establish a MUPL account, and then it applied all previous payments that had been coming in over the last 2 years and future payments were diverted from general fund to this new other fund account. But in the process of doing that, it pulled $106 million out of the general fund and reduced the estimated surplus kicker refund by a similar amount, by $106 million. So the net effect was to make $106 million more available in all funds resources. So it was the biggest revenue measure shaping the 0103 budget. The opinion we had from counsel was that because this was a measure that was essentially rearranging revenue sources, it required a majority vote. That's something that may be an issue in the future.
Representative Hess.
Since we're on this pause, and since we're going to be looking at new revenue possibilities, where do things stand with doing something like this now, or what is the feasibility of opening this can of worms, perhaps in a special session?
Representative Hass, from a technical standpoint, the opinion of counsel is that you have the authority to shift funds around, move them from general fund to other fund. And an indirect result of that is if it occurs after a close of session forecast has been established, and the 2% surplus kicker legislation makes it clear you refer back to the close of regular session forecast, then you do have the possibility of these influencing the kicker in this way through making other kinds of budget shifts. Now, technically, it is possible to do that again. In this case, though, I think one of the things that really stood out is that the MUPL account itself was kind of indirect federal money, and there was no other federal revenue sources that were flowing into the general fund. So it was unique in that respect.
Mr. Chair. Representative Brown.
Paul, the 2% kicker, when does it fade out?
2% surplus kicker, Representative Brown, you should be getting it in about before December 1 is what the statute reads. And the department may have something more specific, but usually they should start to go out in November.
Well, the department does not have anything more specific.
They don't.
Intentionally.
And my understanding from the department is that they don't bail them out all at once. The post office has asked them to do it in increments. So that's what they do. But I think those checks are pretty much prepped and ready to go, or will be soon. And they statutorily, they have to be out by December 1.
Do you know how many dollars that represents?
The kicker estimate is $254 million. It's about a 6%. It is about a 6% refund on your 2000 liability. So the next piece of legislation that was significant, and this is one that has become a major policy issue nationally. A lot of states have looked at this.
I'm sorry, Paul, I'm just formulating a question before we move on to this. Back to the MUPL money, and this kind of came from Representative Hass's question. I've seen your memo, and I guess I want to clarify on the record, is there more MUPL money in the pipeline than we had at than what we factored in Senate Bill 963?
The MUPL estimate was based on, well, there was a couple of things there. We had estimated there was $106 million in MUPL money was in the May forecast for the 9901 biennium. That turned out to be about 113. So actually, it reduced the kicker by 113. As it turned out. But there was also a flow of revenue coming in this biennium, 01-03. So when you add all of that up and look at the allocations from that, and it was allocated to a series of things, including the schools, got $99 million of it, at the end of session, there was an estimated $118 million of unallocated MUPL money.
That's beyond the 106 or 113.
So yes, when you add the 113 plus the revenue that was expected this biennium, I believe it came out to about 334. I think it is. It's over $300 million, and so of that, I can get you those specific numbers, but. But after the allocations were made, the total amount of unallocated was about $118 million. And LFO is again looking at those numbers along with DAS and to see where they are. And right now, they were and the possibility maybe slightly more than that, but it's still right around that amount. Of course, the issue around the MUPL as well is that it is it's strictly the result of federal policy, and so federal policy can change, so there's a real element of uncertainty there around those dollars.
And unappropriated MUPL money would go into the ending balance? Is that the...
Yes.
Okay.
In the ending balance of the MUPL account.
Yes, right.
Not in the general fund. Yeah. So it has a separate account.
Thank you.
House Bill 2281, as I said, is dealing with the corporate income tax apportionment formula, and this has been an issue, I think, I would say over the last year or 2 years, probably the state tax issue that's gotten the most attention nationally. As many states have looked at it. 8 states have gone to a single sales factor. A number of them have looked at increasing that sales factor. What this bill did was increase the sales factor and decrease our property and payroll factors. We had already had a system in which we placed a double weight on the sales. What House Bill 2281 has increased that to 80%. It did allow for utilities and telecom taxpayers to stay within the existing formula, the formula of 50% sales, 25 property, 25 payroll. And it applies to corporate income earned on or after May 1, 2003. So we don't think it has any revenue impact this by any. That, of course, was because of those short-run factors we talked about before influencing the 0103 budget. I'm experimenting with different colors here. I'm not sure.
Yeah, we prefer the blue.
I'm going to reject that one.
So the revenue implications, or the economic and revenue implications of House Bill 2281, it reduces the tax burden for about a third of the corporation. But that one-third of corporations make up about 60% of revenue.
Of corporate?
Yes, corporate income tax revenue, yes. And they tend to be, as you might expect, thinking about the formula, they tend to be manufacturers. Because they are the ones who have the property and payroll in the state. So they're producing in the state and exporting out. It increases the tax burden for two-thirds of corporations, but they make up less than half of the corporate income tax collection. So what we did was go through, take Department of Revenue data. We've got the returns of every corporate income taxpayer, and it's very easy to go in. I shouldn't say because they do it, but it's an easy conceptually go in, change the apportionment formula, and see what happens to tax collection. That would give us what we call a static revenue impact. Okay, if nothing else changed, we just change the formula, and then we use the revenue forecast to project out, we would have $65 million less in corporate tax collections in 03-05 and $71 million less in 05-07. Again, because about one-third of the corporations are a bigger portion of the tax base, they'll get a tax reduction from the new apportionment formula. The economic feedback effects, however, we think are significant. So we used our Oregon Tax Incidence Model, OTIM, to go through and estimate what those effects are. And what they showed was a total revenue impact that was 18.1% smaller than the static revenue impact. This is total, including local revenue and non-general fund revenue. General fund only, just corporate tax collections, was 11.3% smaller. But OTIM estimates what things would be like after all adjustments have taken place. We assume that takes 5 years for those economic adjustments to take place, primarily investment of new capital. So we've adjusted the revenue impact for those feedback effects, and you can see in 03-05, general fund revenue is $62 million less instead of $65 million, and 05-07 is $65 million less instead of $71. So that's the 11% reduction after 5 years. Again, one of the things that was talked about quite a bit during the discussion during the session was this is part of my long-term competition for productive factors with other states, and it does depend on what other states do, particularly California, what the ultimate impact is of the measure.
Any news from California?
I don't, not, I, you know, they're not in session, and they're not, they didn't pass anything.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nolan.
That gets to one of my questions. California being a big influence, are there other major states who's, who have this sort of shift pending? And the second part of my question is, since revenue forecasts are changing since the session, certainly since the May forecast, what has changed in your economic model that might influence your economic feedback analysis on this bill today as compared with back in May when you did the analysis?
The first part of the question in terms of other states, really the region that has been most aggressive in going to sales factor is the upper Midwest. I mean, they're the export-oriented region, manufacturing-oriented. Michigan has a 90% sales factor. Illinois has gone to 100%. Wisconsin has looked at changing theirs, has not done so. Minnesota has a 70% sales factor. So Iowa, of course, is the state that has the original single sales, and they did it back in the 30s. So it's that upper Midwest region that's very aggressive in export and manufacturing, exporting manufactured goods. We've seen some other states go in that direction. Texas, for example, has gone to a single sales. The West has been less aggressive. Of course, Washington doesn't have the issue because they don't have a corporate income tax. In some ways, they already have a single sales factor through the B&O tax. California has looked at it but not gone in that direction. I don't know where Idaho is on it. They have not gone in that direction of a more pronounced sales factor. So really, it's been the Midwest states and that have been much more aggressive on this. The Western states have not moved strongly in this direction. The South and the East is still largely goes with a three-factor formula, particularly the South. I guess we have seen some movement in the East, too, because Maryland did go to a sales factor in the last session. They're the only state in the last session that did go to a single sales factor.
Before we get to the second part of my question, have you coordinated with the Department of Economic Development so that we're focusing on the states that they consider Oregon to be most directly in competition with for jobs? It's interesting academically, and every state should be on the list for consideration, but if we're vying more with certain states for location of plants or for relocation of plants, it would seem to me that those ought to be the ones we care most about, because if we're not likely to be in competition with Minnesota for plant locations, I don't care what their tax structure looks like, as much as California, Washington, and other states that OEDD is particularly focusing on.
We did receive input during the hearings from Economic Development Department. I would characterize those as generally supportive. You know, the argument is that whether you take this kind of a step as a first mover versus defensive strategy. So you get into that whole debate as to, you know, what role you want to play, but we don't have the strong defensive argument that you might have if you were a Minnesota.
The Economic Development Department did write a letter. As I recall, that letter could be best characterized as saying, we can't tell you what we think about this because we haven't been authorized, but we like it. And that was sort of the gist of it, wasn't it? And committee members recall. There is a letter in the record from Economic Development. And you mentioned the defensive strategy, and you addressed location and relocation, and the other one is retention.
And Representative Nolan, your second question on how this economic environment, changing economic environment, affects our impact. Our model is not a forecasting model. It is a model where we shock our system and look at how things would change and come back to a new equilibrium. So the way that a recession affects that model is primarily through the length of adjustment, that five-year period. If you have a downtime economically, probably means you're looking at 6, 7, 8 years instead of 5 years. And the reason I say that is if what you're doing with this with any tax policy is you're trying to reduce the cost to capital for your region compared to other regions. Well, if there's a lot of excess capacity in the system, which you have during recessions, people aren't investing. Businesses are not investing. So it doesn't matter if your region's now more attractive. If there's no investment taking place or less investment taking place, then you won't get the benefits. So the net effect is to spread it out or delay it and until things come back again and you're looking at new investment opportunities.
In terms of the actual dollar amounts, isn't it true that the dollar amounts that you have up there for static revenue impact and the ultimate, the adjusted impact, those would likely be less in a recession scenario just because tax collections are down generally?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. The overall amount of corporate income collections would be lower, therefore this net effect would be lower. That's correct.
Mm-hmm.
They would be proportionally about
right.
the same.
Yeah.
Just a comment, Mr. Chair. If you stretch that payback period out too far, if you take into account the time value of money, you never catch up. And that's, I think, the real impact that the recession has. If you're paying up front by foregoing revenue, and it takes you 10 years to get back to the point where you're starting to recover it, you never really support the services, as your earlier chart talked about, that depend on those revenue collections.
How did you vote on this? I'm going to guess.
Okay, Mr. Chair, we're ready for part two of our tag team here.
All right.
I'll turn it over to Ed.
Ed Waters, the famous...
Charlie Waters, the famous Charlie. Muddy. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Ed Waters, Economist and Legislative Revenue Office. I work with the income tax areas, personal income tax, corporate income tax, revenue forecast analysis, and the kicker, which is interesting highlight of the revenue forecast.
And the trainer of OTIN.
That's right, the trainer and feeder.
I crack the whip with OTIN. Today I'd like to go over two bills, Senate Bill 764 and House Bill 2716, with you briefly. Back to the blue background. It's more soothing. Senate Bill 764 reauthorizes and restructures the pollution control tax credit. And the first thing it does in that vein is it maintains a safe harbor, really, for projects which were started construction prior to January 1, 2001. They're still eligible for the current credit structure, that is, maximum 50% of their certified pollution control costs. But where the restructuring really begins is that Senate Bill 764 creates a new upper tier for certain kinds of new projects going forward. Those upper-tier projects would be eligible for the new maximum, 35% of certified pollution control facility costs. The bill also phases out the credit for projects that do not meet these new criteria. So some of the traditional sorts of pollution control projects would eventually no longer be eligible for the credit. The bill also disallows the credit for up to 5 years if a taxpayer is convicted of environmental offenses that are related to the facility applying for or using the credit. It also allows an additional 3-year carry forward for unused tax credits under if certain circumstances are met. And finally, the bill commissions an interim pollution control tax credit review task force, which would operate during this current interim. The new upper tier of projects created under Senate Bill 764 that, as I mentioned, will be eligible for the maximum, the new maximum, 35% of certified costs, include projects with state-of-the-art environmental standards and pollution control type systems. And these include the International Organization for Standardization, or ISO 14001, certified facilities holding a Department of Environmental Quality issued green permit, and also facilities which can obtain a certified environmental management system statement through a certification process. Also, other projects eligible for the upper tier are those which go above and beyond what would be the legally required pollution control measures for that type of a facility or the type of emissions that they entail. Also, non-point source, and in that read mostly agricultural, non-point source and confined animal feeding operations, or CAFO, C-A-F-O, would be eligible for the upper tier. Also, recycling of agricultural and forest products, materials recovery and recycling operations, and small projects, that is, projects less than $200,000 certified cost, would be eligible.
Ed?
Yes.
What about economically depressed?
Mr. Chair, that's a good point. Also, there was an addendum to Senate Bill 764.
Oh, you're okay. That's right. That wasn't 764. That came in at midnight on the in the conference committee in the other bill, but yeah, that's still part of the package.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. It was a modification to the pollution control credit restructuring projects in economically distressed areas or rural enterprise zones would also potentially be eligible for the maximum upper tier credit.
It's interesting looking back at your third slide. All the factors shaping policy. This one has elements both of environmental policy, but also regional disparities with that economic development piece in the package as well.
Regarding the phase out of the lower tier type projects, projects underway before January 1, 2001. As I mentioned, they're eligible for a safe harbor treatment, and they're still eligible to receive up to 50% of their certified costs as they were under the old program. Projects commenced between or during 2001, 2002, and 2003, after that, would be eligible for 25% of certified costs only. Projects commenced during 2004 and 2005 would be eligible for up to 15% of certified costs, and there would be no credit allowed for these lower tier type projects commenced after December 31, 2005. Regarding the revenue impact of Senate Bill 764, we estimated that in 0103, it would reduce revenues by about $830,000, 0305 by almost $5 million, and in 0507 it would reduce revenues by about $7.7 million. Note that these impacts are less than what would have resulted if the existing program had simply been extended, and they're about half, actually, of what the revenue impact of simply extending the existing pollution control credit program would have been.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative Eden.
Ed, do we have, or is there any way to assess the negative impact of projects not being built because of the lack of the tax credits?
Representative Hayden, members of the committee, We don't have a model to look at that. It would be, I guess, up to some case study types of treatments where you look at evidence of a project that would, I guess, otherwise have gone forward but for this kind of constraint, and what the negative impact or the benefits foregone of that kind of a project would be, or in that situation would be. We don't have the capability to do that. And maybe one thing that this interim pollution control credit task force might address, that kind of a scenario. They were commissioned to look at the effectiveness of the pollution control credit in one, controlling pollution or improving environmental quality, and two, the economic development kinds of effects of having pollution control credits available to incent these types of projects in specifically or particularly underdeveloped type areas.
Mr. Chairman,
sure.
It would just, you know, just in retrospect now in looking at this, we cover so many things during the session that sometimes you miss a few things, but it would seem that although we would lose immediate revenue following Representative Nolan's line of reasoning, if we had 110% tax credit, we would have better environmental results and a good more employment in the state. We would have immediate loss of corporate revenue, of course.
Well, I think as with as with this, and also back to the supervised sales factor, those are just some of the dynamic elements of a change in tax policy that I think are always going to be hard to measure. But we know they're out there; it's just hard to put the finger on them.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. No additional questions regarding Senate Bill 764. We can move to House Bill 2716, which.
Take a lot of time on this one. Go slow.
Modifies the personal income tax credit, known as the Working Family Child Care Tax Credit, which was originally created in the 1997 legislature to help low-income families be able to afford the rising costs of child care, and thereby be more able to participate in the labor force, was the reasoning. House Bill 2716 changes the working family tax credit from a non-refundable credit, as it originally was, to a refundable credit, beginning with the 2003 tax year. What this means is that the taxpayers claiming the credit will now be able to get the full amount of their credit eligibility, not limited by their tax liability. So if they fill out their worksheet and it shows they can claim $300, but they only have $100 of tax liability, they would be able to use that $300 credit to offset their remaining tax liability and also additionally get a $200 refund check in the mail. This is currently Oregon's only refundable type tax credit. By the way, the House Bill 2716 also continuously appropriates amounts necessary to make the refunds, the amount of the refund that is in excess of existing tax liability. It also modifies the calculation of the $6,000 minimum earnings limit, which was in the original program, and it modifies this calculation so that the limit, which is indexed for inflation, so $6,000 will grow over time as the CPI increases. It modifies that $6,000 limit so that it would never exceed what a worker would earn working half-time at the minimum wage. So that was one of the original criteria in the original bill. Family had to be working, had to be earning at least a minimum amount of income in order to be eligible for the credit. The last thing that House Bill 2716 does is that it tied the success, the passage, effective nest, I guess, at House Bill 2716 to the fortunes of House Bill 2281. It only allowed House Bill 2716 to go through and take effect if House Bill 2281 also did. And that happened, and so now we have both programs.
I think that was Representative Rosenbaum's immortal sausage link speech on the floor.
By way of a little bit of background, as I mentioned, the credit was created by the 1997 legislature in order to help low-income families offset their child care costs. Prior to 2001 tax year, taxpayers with up to 150% of federal poverty level were allowed the maximum amount of the credit, and that is equal to 40% of their qualified child care expenses. After 150% of federal poverty level, there's phase out with increasing income level so that taxpayers above 200% of federal poverty level were not eligible to receive the credit at all. This was changed by the 1999 legislature so that beginning 2001, taxpayers with up to 200% now of federal poverty level were able to get the maximum amount of the credit, and then the phase out began so that eventually taxpayers above 250% of federal poverty level were not eligible for the credit. So it moved the scale up 50 percentage points of federal poverty level, basically. Revenue impact of House Bill 2716, because of the delayed implementation, it had no impact in the current biennium, estimated to have impact of $15.2 million in 03-05 and $16.5 million minus in 05-07. That concludes my two bills or two bits.
Okay. Dick Yates, for new committee members, this is a good way for us to get introduced to staff. Dick is our timber and transportation guru.
Morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Gates, legislative revenue. Don't forget excise taxes.
Thank you.
Today, though, just two groups of areas that we're looking at in terms of legislation from the last session, and that is timber tax and transportation. The last session essentially took legislation that was passed in the 99 session and sort of completed the program, so it wasn't a new program initiated by the 2001 legislature, but a sort of final designing and defining of the 1999 program. The 1999 program had called for an interim review by the Department of Revenue of forest land values. House Bill 3537 deals with this question. That's really the only change in the 99 program. House Bill 2162 basically said that all forest land is going to be subject to the program that was designed in the 99 session. So you had, prior to the 2001 session, you had small owners in one program with an option to be taxed as large owners, large owners in a separate program designed by the 99 legislature. And the large owner in this case is where the forest land is in an ownership of 5,000 or over acres. So what 2162 does then is say that by calendar year 2003, all forest land is subject to the provisions of the of what was previously the large owner program. And then for the fiscal 2003-2004, property taxes are all determined by that 1999 legislation. The other thing that was changed in the 2001 session, prior to 2003, what you have are statutory values, values set by site class in Western Oregon and for Eastern Oregon per acre. And those were then indexed and brought forward each year to get the applicable specially assessed value for forest land. That's all gone as of 2003, and the Department of Revenue is required annually to make an estimate of the specially assessed value by site class in Western Oregon and for all of Eastern Oregon. So that has changed. The other significant change was the imposition of a new limit on assessed value for the 2003-2004. You can sort of think of this as maximum assessed value under Measure 50. It's not, but it serves that same purpose for 1 year, and then it becomes the value in that year, and maximum assessed value thereafter is 3% increase of those values. But those these new values come out of the interim study, and in general, they're, at least for high site classes, they're lower. We'll look at those values in just a moment. The other change is one of the concerns of the 99 legislature was that as the property taxes move to 100%, essentially, of maximum assessed value or specially assessed value, that you'd have a lot of value appeals. And so they asked the department to design a class action appeal process so that you could avoid those appeals and still have an opportunity to make sure that the system was not arriving at values in excess of real market value.
Not avoid the appeals, but you mean just consolidate them?
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You didn't have just thousands of appeals.
Correct.
Yeah, separately.
And the last, again, the 99 legislature had required a study of the taxation of small ownership, forest land and small ownership. That study did not arrive at recommendations for the legislature. And so the 2001 session has asked this time the Department of Forestry to convene groups to deal with whether or not there should be a special method of taxing small owners. The charge out of the 99 session was to design a program where the small owners would pay a significant portion of their tax at the time of harvest rather than just the annual property tax. So that's ongoing.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I want to follow up on that because earlier on in your testimony you said that the new program would apply to all forest landowners, and now you say there may be an exemption for the small landowners.
Well, there's no statutory difference. It would have to be the 2003 legislature, which would create a different program for small owners.
The Department of Forestry is studying a program, and then the legislature would have to implement that.
That's
in the absence of that happening, it would apply to all landowners.
That's correct.
Thank you.
And yeah, that work group met through the last interim, and they're at it. I hope they're at it again by now, but they've got representatives of the small woodland owners and forestry and revenue and county assessors. I think it's a good mixed group. They just didn't get there in this last session, so they asked for an extension of time, and I think the trade-off was, you know, we'll give you the extension of time, but at some point we've got to have an end to this, and either we're going to figure out a new program or you're going to fall into the program for the large forest landowners so that everybody's treated the same way.
Just reviewing the two programs that are out there, the 93 program really, which is sometimes called the 80-20 program. Anyway, this program goes away under current law and is repealed in 2003 as far as privilege taxes are concerned, and for the 2003-2004 fiscal year as far as property taxes are concerned. And just to review for you what the program involves, the privilege tax on any harvest is 3.2% on the west side and 1.8% on the east side. Those will go away. There will be no privilege taxes under the 2001 program. Property taxes, currently the values are determined statutorily and indexed forward, and property tax for people in this the 1993 program, which is, let me back up for a second, I guess the 99 program was designed for large owners, but there was an option that small owners could elect to be taxed under that program. So far, I think it's 22 who have. So basically, they've not found it attractive. And then by under the 99 program, as of 2003, they were automatically put into the large owner program, but they had an option to elect out into this program. And that's what was taken away in 2001. The program goes, that option goes away. The change for them will be then that instead of their property taxes, the forest land values going on at 20% of those statutory values, or the maximum assessed value, whichever is less, they'll be taxed like the large owners at 100% of the maximum assessed value or their specially assessed value. So that goes away. Now, to look at the 2000 or the 99 program, essentially, that's phased in so that it's completely in effect by 2003 as far as privilege taxes are concerned. Privilege taxes are on a calendar year basis. And so for 2000 and the rest of this year, the privilege tax rates are 1.9% on the west and 1.1% on the east side. Now, those all go to schools. 93% goes into the state school fund and 7% into the community college support fund. If you think back beyond, again, to the 93 program, you had these distributions, these very complex distribution systems to get the money back to the local districts. That's all gone now with the 99 legislation. So that by 2003, this disappears, essentially, as a source for school funding. Now, if you look at the property taxes for, again, 2001 fiscal year through 2003, forest land is on at 75% of its specially assessed value, or its maximum assessed value. And then when the program is completed, 2003 and thereafter, it goes on at 100% of its maximum assessed value.
So we're doing that as phasing out the privilege tax as we ramp up to the 100%
correct
value on property. For committee, for background, this really goes back to Measure 50. When that was passed, of course, it established a 3% limit on the increase in property taxes, except that forest landowners weren't taxed on property. They were taxed on the basis of the privilege tax.
On the harvest.
On harvest, yeah. And so there was an open question, I think litigated, but I'm not sure it was litigated to resolution because of the action the legislature took, as to whether the privilege tax was limited by the, basically whether Measure 50 applied to the privilege tax, I think. That was one of the questions. And I guess the issue being then that forest landowners then were not getting the benefit of the limit on the increase in property taxes that every other property owner was getting. And so this shift came about to move forest landowners into a status equivalent to other property owners so that their taxes now will be limited by that 3% increase under Measure 50. Is that about right?
Yes, that's certainly the issue that was out there,
right,
and the reason for addressing the question. I'm not sure that issue ever got into court. There was an issue in court at that time with dealing with the fact that the severance tax was different on the east and west side, and there wasn't really a justification for a difference in the rates. And so it was a question of whether that was constitutional or not.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
yeah.
With your permission, if you or Mr. Yates could explain to me what happens with a small landowner who paid the privilege tax, who cut all their timber 5 years ago, paid the privilege tax, and is now faced with being not in being taxed in 50 years again at the next cycle, but next year for property taxes. Am I thinking this through?
Well, that's one of the reasons they're looking at retaining some sort of a small woodland owner program. That's precisely what the small woodland issue is.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
To look at the values that came out of the interim study, what I have here, I should have on the slide, but I didn't put it in there, is that these are what the values would be under these two programs for the 2003-2004 year. Values, of course, are going to change, but and these are maximum assessed values. So if you have high site land, which is the best land in Western Oregon, FA, under the 99 program, the index statutory values would come up about $840. Maximum assessed value would be about $840. The new values which were put into House Bill 3537, the new limits for this 1 year, are $450 per acre on that best site class land. And you can see for FB and FA, the good site classes, there's about a 50% reduction in values. But as you move down, the reduction actually diminishes and turns around here for FE and FF, site classes, where the values have actually gone up from what those statutory values were. And again, there's not much change in Eastern Oregon.
And Dick, the process by which those values were determined, that was in the interim group again from last interim with Department of Revenue and OFIC and...
Yes, the Department of Revenue was charged to do a study. They actually contracted out to private contractors to get estimates both through an income approach and through a market value approach.
And those are the values that were incorporated in the bill?
Those are the maximum assessed, yeah. The limits in the bill came from that process. Also coming out of that process, I think, was the decision to not put specially assessed values into statute, but have the department do that process of estimating those annually. I think we go to transportation. Last slide on timber is the revenue impact. Now, this is kind of hard because whether you assign the revenue impact to the 99 legislation or the 2001 legislation depends on how small owners behave. So I've kind of avoided really trying to deal in detail with that question. But if you look at the 99 program, large owners are in that program, and you can look at how they would be affected by the 2001 program. The only change is in the value of the forest land, so there's no change. By 2003, there is no privilege tax. It's gone away, so the 2001 legislation had no impact. The impact on property taxes through these low reduced forest land values that we saw just a moment ago is about a $6.8 million reduction in the property taxes that will be paid by the large owners. On the small owners, I assume that they all stayed with the 93 program through 2003 and then that they're moved automatically into the large owner program. In 2003, had the 99 program applied to them, they would have paid, you know, on average about $5.4 million in severance taxes and about $1.6 million in property tax. Under the new program that they're forced into, and if in fact they do get forced into that program, they will pay no severance taxes, but their property taxes will go up to about $3.9 million, so that the net savings, essentially, to them as a group would be about $3.15 million a year. I was thinking of something, but it doesn't come back to me.
Question? Question?
This is fully phased in the, so I understand this, the tax burden will be 100% property tax on large timber owners.
Yes. Now, 100%, really what will control is the maximum assessed value under Measure 50, and 100% of that value will go on the roll.
Okay.
Traditionally, we're thinking of 20% of that going on the roll, and 80% of the remaining 80% being raised through privilege taxes.
Harvest, right. So now that it's 100%, they cut a tree down, that won't affect their tax bill.
That's correct.
So whether they harvest or not, it won't affect their property tax bill.
It will not affect their property tax bill, and it won't affect, and there won't be any privilege tax.
Is there any ramification to that? Is there any? Does that create some sort of incentive for them not to harvest or to harvest? Do you think?
One of the arguments you go back to the 1977, I guess, when the severance tax was put in effect, one of the arguments was that the continual, well, at that time you had timber on the roll as well, the value of the standing timber, not just the forest land. And so as the crop became more valuable, the property taxes became a large portion, became very large. And so there was a big incentive to cut those trees down and reduce the property tax. Now you've got an annual burden that goes on, which is a regular fixed cost in a sense, the property tax on the value of the forest land. And whether you cut or not is not going to affect that tax. So I guess I'm just thinking about this a little bit as I'm talking to you, but I guess I would not see, at least off the top of my head, any incentives one way or the other.
If I could just follow up, is when those appraisals are done for that kind of land, are you saying that they don't factor in the value of the timber in the appraisal, or how?
That's correct. I mean, the 93 legislation specified a change in tax policy, so that the timber itself is exempt, like inventories are exempt for certain types of businesses. Now, in a market sense, the real market value of forest land is certainly dependent upon what you can sell the trees for. And if you're doing like the department did, an income approach to valuing forest land during the interim, you would be looking at the value of the trees that they can grow off. And, you know, right now the only value that real market value has is that that's another limit on what you can have assessed value. Assessed value may not exceed, especially assessed value, may not exceed maximum assessed value, but it also may not exceed real market value. And that's that appeal process that we were talking about. If you begin to get situations where that's questionable, you would find class action lawsuits under the bill now, arguing that the maximum assessed values being on the roll exceed real market values.
Representative Hayden had a question.
Is forest land then treated much like farmland, agricultural land, or will it be treated differently? And will the revenue impacts and costs be much the same for farmers as for forest landowners?
I really thought about that question, but I think, yeah, the treatment is fairly similar in the sense that you go through generally some sort of valuation process as far as getting at farmland values, and that frequently is an income approach to determining the value. And those are subject to maximum assessed value under Measure 50. So I would think that the process is fairly similar.
Thank you.
Representative Brown.
Representative Hayden asked some of my questions. And at the timberlands and the trees that are growing there would be dealt with a great deal like farmland and the crops that they grow there. And it would be very similar then, right?
And that was the policy, essentially, of the 93 legislature, that forest land should be treated like
93 or 99?
Like an agricultural.
99.
93, really.
93. Oh, okay, right.
When standing timber.
Yes, right, sure. Mm-hmm.
On the transportation?
Sure.
2142, basically we're dealing here with bonding. Oh, that's not very loud.
Oh, no.
2142 gave the Department of Transportation authority to issue $400 million in revenue bonds and dedicated $71.2 million annually from the highway fund for debt service of those bonds. And sometimes in the past, the debt service has been tied like to a penny or to some source, and this time it was not. It's flat 71. That 71 goes out every year. Now, it's true that there were certain increases in fees which were intended to raise that money, but it doesn't matter whether they raise more or less. $71 million still goes out for debt service. And that goes into a transportation investment account, and any money that's not needed for debt service is distributed back with a new distribution formula. Currently, about 60% goes to the state, 24 to the counties, and 16, I think it is, to the cities. But under this new distribution formula, any excess in that transportation investment account, 50% goes to the state, 30% to the counties, and 20% to the cities. Now, the ODOT came out, Mazen Malik came out yesterday with the forecast for the highway fund. And what they've sort of tentatively scheduled there is about 25 to 30 million actually being distributed as unnecessary revenues from that account throughout per year for the 2001-2003 biennium. So there will be some monies, at least at this point in time, it's expected there'll be a significant amount of monies actually going back to the cities and counties and to the state as well for programming. That then falls rather rapidly to about 20 million in the next biennium and about 6 in the following biennium. So most of that money will be needed for debt service, but during the phase-up period, when you're getting, you know, ready to do something, you don't need the bonds, you don't need the debt service. The fee increases were in two bills, really. House Bill 3068 raised various fees, which the Attorney General said those services that were being provided could not be paid for with constitutionally dedicated funds. So the fees are raised then to cover the cost of those services, and these go into a new operating account for the Highway Department, which they can use to fund non-highway service. It's a source of money which is not constitutionally dedicated to highway construction. Those fees then bring in new money, and since the cost of those services were previously funded from highway funds, it essentially frees up highway funds. And those freed up funds are then one of the sources of the debt service money. The other was an increase in title fees. Title fees were $10. It was determined by the Department of Transportation that they needed $17 to cover the cost of providing that titling fee, titling of vehicles. and so there was an increase actually in House Bill 2139 to 17, which was bringing all of these fees up to where they covered the cost of those services. And then House Bill 2142 repealed that increase to 17 and took the increase to $30 for automobiles and to $90 for trucks. All right, and that's the major source then of the funding for debt service.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Hayden.
If you know, Mr. Yates, and if not, you can tell me later, how much general fund is in the highway fund or in the Department of Transportation?
I don't have that off the top of my head, but I can get it for you.
Thank you.
To look at the program here, what we have is eligible projects. The Transportation Commission is finally the bottom line responsible for designated the projects which will be constructed with these bond revenues. They're limited to modernization and preservation projects, and the bill, House Bill 2142, actually specifies the types of projects. Look at the bill. I didn't lay out all of them here, but it deals with, like, bridges where there are weight limits, with expanding lane capacity, types of projects that they can do. Then once you've got a list of all these projects, it specifies how you actually select among those projects, assuming you've got more projects than can be done with $400 million. And it requires that the department come make the selection, the commission make the selection by February 1, 2002, and you actually get those projects into the STIP. The expected issuance of bonds then is $100 million in the this biennium, $200 million in the next, and final completion then of the projects and of the use of the bonding authority in the 2005-2007 biennium. all, of course, subject to change.
Okay. Thank you, Dick. I think that's, we're at our breaking point. I mean, we're at a point for the break. And Steve, if I can, let's defer you. It might even be to after lunch. We've got Tom Potowski coming in. I want to make sure we give him time. And then if we can sandwich you in even before lunch, maybe with the small, in talking about the small school study, that'd be a good education unit right there. So we'll try and do that. It didn't be flexible. But let's go ahead and do that, trying to stick to our schedule. We'll take a break until 10:48, and then come on back here if we can be ready to go then. Got Tom Potowski coming over to give us the sort of the peak, what's happened since the September forecast. Okay? We'll be adjourned. I'm sorry, recess.